This is Fam Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Sean Carlton. And you're a podcaster yourself. You have two podcasts, CEO of the Dark Age Media and publisher of Same Old Lives. So we can talk more about your podcast as we introduce you to the audience. But welcome to the Fam Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
Doing real good, Phantom. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, let people know we are a featured podcast on the Newsly platform. We'll be on there later tonight. And so if you use that coupon code GHOST, you can try that out. If you never tried out Newsly, you can use that GHOST coupon and check us out later tonight. This episode, an audio only version, will be there tonight. We also have Sam, samolives.substack.com, your URL. And that will be fully clickable when we're published, so you won't have to remember that, but that will stay here. And then we also want to talk about your podcast and Dark Age Media. So again, welcome to the show. And we always preface when we talk to people, we have two questions we always start at the beginning, like, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Well, what motivates me is that I really want to kind of, one, utilize the digital landscape, digital media landscape as it is right now. I also kind of want to change it too. I see there's a lot of room for growth, especially in podcasting. It's been around for a while, but I think it has a lot of room that can continually improve. And in my own adventures with podcasting, I have seen where it can go, and I've grown even in my own right. So I think it has a huge growth potential to it. So, yeah. And the other question was, what keeps me going?
Yeah. Well, it's like, why, you know, what motivates you? Why do you do what you do? Like, what's your passion point? Like, of why you do it?
My passion point is just for the people that I speak to. Like, whenever I get someone on either of my podcasts, a brand new person, I get to talk to someone new that has a different perspective, has different ideas, has different different backgrounds, different energies, and just all kinds of things that I can just take away from the conversation, even just speaking for an hour. And even just speaking for an hour at one time, you know, I haven't had a follow-up interview yet in my podcasting career, but I've debated it because there's some people out there I really want to catch up with that I haven't spoken to since, you know, maybe 2 years ago when I started this. So it's the adventure really of just kind of meeting and talking to new people. That's what keeps me going.
That's interesting. Like, so follow-ups, what you never wanted to have the follow-ups. You always wanted to have like new people, like new blood coming in. Was that like a conscious decision, or you just ended up doing it that way?
I just kind of ended up doing it that way. I guess for a lot of people, I guess we kind of, we covered everything at that point that was to cover, you know, and a lot of people, you know, we left off, they had more projects in the works here, and I just hadn't gotten back to them about where they're at with things. So really out of just, it just kind of was that way because I hadn't had a chance to kind of reach back to anyone and say, hey, how are things going? We spoke about this when we last spoke, where is it at now? That kind of thing. You know, a lot of these people are very busy too. And so, you know, just getting them once was kind of a blessing. was a blessing. So just kind of pinning them down one time. So going for a second helping there seemed like sometimes asking for more than you can get.
That's interesting. Because I, like, when I started, I was dealing primarily with emerging and independent singer-songwriters. And because they had albums and tours, a lot of times I got them to come back for their next album or their next tour, because they needed the promotion. And so it was kind of like that was like the synergy of what was going on. And then same thing with some authors that have like another book. And so they want to promote the book, but, you know, it's just different methods of how, what you feel comfortable with. Like if your mindset or how you present your show is, everybody does their show the different way. And, you know, within the podcasting world, it has, you know, I started on a cell phone. With like whatever an iPhone was like 5 years ago. That's what I did. And I didn't do, had you always been like in one format or the other? Are you primarily audio or video?
I was always audio and video. My setup currently today is more or less what it was just 2 years ago. I mean, I utilize a microphone more than I did, but even that's kind of gone back and forth. I just kind of went back into it, you know, a couple months ago using a microphone. I thought my laptop microphone was okay, but then I kind of decided this sounds a little bit better. It doesn't sound bad without it, but it just sounds a little bit better. And I have an additional light here, a little cubicle light that gives me additional lighting. And, you know, it's grown and gotten a bit more sophisticated in the 2 years, but it's more or less the same as it was when I first started out with. I mean, it's just me and my laptop. And well, actually, when I started out podcasting, the first couple, about half dozen episodes are just me speaking. So, and then I know I kind of got bored just me talking. I thought that sounded kind of boring. So I figured, hey, I might as well branch out here and see if I can actually get people on to talk to me.
Yeah.
And yeah, right. And so that's where Podmatch came into. And I've met all kinds of very interesting people. And Podmatch is really cool because otherwise I can't see how I would have met even half of these people without it. And it's that's been
interesting.
So there are mostly virtual meetups here, although the first person I did interview was an in-person interview here. So I booked some space at the local library here, and she was local to where I live. And this was for Fitness Reborn. And she ran this really cool organization called HEMA. That was the acronym. It was like Historical European Martial Arts Society, something like that.
Wow.
And it's basically where they do jousting. They do mock jousting and they do real jousting. If you got signed up for it, you could do like the mock jousting, which is just like you're playing around. You're not actually hurting each other or doing anything like that, or fighting. And or if you really want to get into it, you could go the extra mile and actually do the real fights. she was part of the real fighting end of things. And yeah, so that was the first person I spoke to, and you know, and she was really cool. We really hit it off, and it was a great interview, and it just encouraged me to want to do more.
That's interesting. Like my first interview experience back in the 2016 was on an app called Spearman. That was an iPhone app that allowed you to podcast, but it was recorded, and it was recorded live with another person. So you couldn't really do it by yourself. You had to find somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I was doing is I initially was approached by a guy that was pitching Spearman, and he was like a radio guy, and he had seen my catalog on SoundCloud, and he said, I want to interview you on a podcast. And I said, what is a podcast? So 5 years ago, I didn't even know what it was. What is that? Like a radio interview? And so I did it.
Much.
And we liked each other so much, we decided to do a co-hosted show about music for like 6 months. And it just came out of that. And then from there, he decided he couldn't do it anymore. His name was Rocktoons, was his stage name, and my fan was mine. And so it was like Rocktoons and Phantom. And we talked about music, we talked about bands, Beatles, everything. And then eventually I started, I had been posting on Instagram these interviews that we would post wherever they were published. And then other musicians said, oh, could I get interviewed? And so I just started getting these. People would say they want to get interviewed, and I had a pitch, and I would just send them on a DM a pitch, and I would get 4 bands a month just doing that.
Nice. So I'm just really curious, like, how did you decide upon the moniker Phantom Electric Ghost?
Well, that's my band. Like, this is my studio. I'm in my home studio. I'm a synthesist. I got my Moogs and my Rolands and my multi-tracks and all kinds of analog gear. But I called myself Phantom Electric Ghost as my band name. It's my, my stage name. And I decided to make the name of my podcast to reflect the same name as my band. You know, my band is called Phantom Electric Ghost, and then podcast is Phantom Electric Ghost. And so we just, I have kind of a couple of hats. And right. and it just like became this thing. Well, it gave me a stage name, and then I didn't have to use my real name. And I kind of like that capability of like being in a band. I had a stage name. I said, well, I'll just continue that with my podcast.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it also kind of leaves, like, if you get known for your real name, sometimes you get hassled. And having some separation for me mm-hmm. was good, because my day job, I'm a software guy. And I'm in the software business as my day job. And, you know, it keeps that kind of added. I have a separate LinkedIn for Phantom versus my LinkedIn for my software design. So I kind of right. keep both worlds separate.
Gotcha. I was just curious. It's really cool.
It's a different way. Because I grew up liking guys that, you know, Prince and Bowie, they created personas, you mm-hmm. know, Freddie Mercury, you know, they're the personas. They would come out with these different versions of themselves. And I was very interested in the theater and stagecraft of that. So I just said, well, you know, I'll do the same idea. And it's kind of based in like science fiction, like mm-hmm. they're seeing the body electric, the idea right. that ghosts have a synthesis and ghosts have like music has frequencies, and electricity and frequencies are in everybody. And it's mm-hmm. like the ghost in the machine. Like if right. you're thinking about like an analog synth, like a Moog, it's kind of magical synthesizers. Like it's like a ghost. Like sometimes they create their own frequencies out of nowhere, at least with analog equipment. And they mm-hmm. kind of feel like they're living. And so I kind of yeah. took advantage of that idea that these analog synths are living things.
And gotcha.
Kind of ghost manipulating it. But that's enough for that.
That's really cool. It's really cool. It's a great story. So I was just very curious, you know, like I guess that's just the host in me coming out. I was just very curious where that came from.
No, it's cool. Yeah. Not that many people ever asked me. Like I've had over 1,000 interviews. There's like 1,088, wow. I think. Well, 87. It's, you know, maybe five people have asked me like where to come from.
I'm glad I'm one of the special five then.
But like podcasting, like you kind of found a way to get into it. Mm-hmm. What made you want to keep doing it? Because there's a metric out there that says podcasters tend to fail after like 6 to 12 episodes and to stop.
Yeah. You know, I don't really know what really kept me in the game. I heard that too. And actually on the anniversary, the 1 year anniversary. Yeah. 1 year anniversary of my podcast, my Fitness Reborn podcast. So it'd be May of 23. I made a special video saying more or less just that. It's like, we've made it 1 year into this. 99% of podcasts are dead by this point. And so, you know, the fact that we've gotten this point this far is pretty, pretty dang special here. So really, I don't know what really kept me going. I guess it was just because if I'm thinking back far enough, things kind of picked up pretty quickly, or at least enough that the momentum was good, that mm-hmm. I found enough reasons to keep going, especially when I got onto Podmatch. And, you know, I really got into like, hey, would you like an interview? Would you like an interview? Would you like to come on? That kind of stuff. And I got more and more people to come on. And the more episodes I got tucked away, the amount of people who started requesting interviews yeah. with me began to pick up. So it was just momentum on top of momentum. And before you know, I got a full calendar. I typically booked out maybe about 3 months in advance on Fitness Reborn, and it just keeps feeding on itself here. And I think after a while too, it was like, I had a lot of interviews stacked up. They kept me going. And also too, the more people I had on, the more people I had scheduled, the more it began to feel like a responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
To show up.
Yeah.
You know, that was right. And that was the other thing too, because I am asking people and hosting people who are PhDs and business owners and very super smart professional people who probably just don't like having their time wasted. And like I said earlier, they're very busy. And so if they can find a pocket of time, and I only interview 2 days a week on Sundays and Mondays. And the fact that they reserve some time out of their schedules to speak with me is probably a big deal. And I didn't want to just not show appreciation for that kind of thing. So I guess it was the momentum, the excitement, the thrill of podcasting, and also the feeling of responsibility to the people that I have scheduled. So, you know, if they didn't show up, which does happen, I've had people, I've had people no show me quite a bit. And, you know, these are, again, professional people, some of them, you know, very educated, very successful people who decide, I guess, who just don't show up. And so, you know, if they do that, they do that. That's on them, but it's not on me. So it's both those things, I really.
Well, I found a way to minimize that. I started coming up with processes. One of my processes is, you know, making sure that I get the Calendly invite form, like making sure that I actually remind them. Like what I noticed, like if certain types of people, if you don't remind them, even if they have a Calendly, they don't show up. So if I started, even if I have a Calendly invite, if I go and I send like a reminder a day before, or maybe 2 days before, then that my no shows like dropped off significantly because I did a little bit of a little interaction of doing that. And you know, over time, I think the feedback loop is great for podcasting. What I like is like you get guests that refer you to other guests, and then they refer you to other guests, and then you get this momentum.
Right.
And it was with musicians, it was happening a lot. Like when I was dealing with musicians, I'd interview a band in a scene, and then that whole scene would want to get interviewed. So if there's multiple bands in that collective, then I end up interviewing them all. So if one band had a good experience, they tell their other band friends, and they all musicians tend to know other musicians.
Sure.
And they would recommend other people. And just like the same thing with authors, they know other authors. And then you just get this continual feedback loop. And it becomes, like you say, a responsibility. Like if I'm showing up and I'm consistent, then it becomes, not that it's a job, it's like a passion thing. It's just, it's like, I got three jobs. I got three things I do. You know, I'm a producer, I'm a podcaster, I'm a musician, but another one, I'm a software guy. So this isn't the only thing I do. But I just find it very fun. And if I wasn't having fun doing it, I probably wouldn't do it. Like if it becomes something that's like not interesting to me, then it won't continue.
Right. And it definitely is fun. And it's definitely something that's taken me out of my comfort zone for the last 2 years because, you know, I'm not a naturally outgoing, gregarious guy. You know, I will be perfectly fine being at home, being by myself. So it's just, you know, it's a lot of fun. And it's really kind of, I think it's kind of given me a lot of personal growth in the last 2 years. And, you know, you're right. If it wasn't any fun, if I just thought it was a constant slog, which I'll be perfectly honest. I mean, sometimes on certain days, it does feel that way. It's like, man, I'm not in the mood to meet anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody right now. I didn't sleep very well. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in a bad mood. I had a bad day yesterday, you know, and I just don't want to meet anybody. So sometimes I do have to drag myself into it. But, you know, the thing is, too, is like once it gets going, it gets better. You know, the bad mood dissipates. And you just kind of you slide into this this alter ego that you have to be when you're on camera. And so, like you were saying about your stage name, it's a lot like doing that. It's like cameras are on, lights are on, it's go time, and you just kind of hit a switch, and you become essentially someone else. And I've had to do that before too in my professional life. You know, I'm a fitness trainer too. I've led groups. Yeah. I'm a fitness trainer. I've done one-on-ones. I've done group classes. I used to teach kickboxing classes. And so, When you're standing up in front of a room full of 30 to 40 people, you know, you have to
Exactly.
You've got to become a different person. At least in my case, some people are very natural just going up in front of others and leading people. That's not me. So I had to really create a different kind of persona that would work in that environment. So I've had to be adaptable in multiple environments.
Well, I find it's kind of like, you know, if you're an athlete, right, and you're practicing that 3-point shot, you do 1,000 reps. It's like a musician that plays their bass guitar and they've done like 10,000 hours of playing. So it's muscle memory.
Right.
And the same thing I feel with like podcasting, like when I first started, I was a mess. Like the first 10 episodes, I probably wouldn't want to listen to.
Right.
You know, 1,000 episodes later,
exactly.
That 1,000 episodes of muscle memory of actually talking to 1,000 people. What I looked at it is like, that is like a masterclass in the human condition. Cause I'm talking to 1,000 other people that have all these ideas I never heard before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, it's like the oral tradition when you go take a class and you're listening to your professor. Well, you learn a lot from that human interaction.
Right.
And the podcast gives us that kind of masterclass situation with somebody that is like, you know, in their field, they're going to talk about what they're into. And you learn a lot. And, you know, even if you're not getting views or metrics or likes or you're the biggest podcast in the world, you are learning as a human being the skill of how to talk to another human being.
Right.
And over time, you get skills that you just become like part of you. And I think it permeates through the rest of my life. You know, how I can talk to people, it's, you know, it's helped me in my business work. Because I feel more comfortable having to present.
I mean, for sure. And it's putting yourself on death ground, you know, which is where a lot of your improvements and your growth will come from is, you know, it's the sink or swim situation, right? So your back is against the wall. What are you going to do? Well, you can't do nothing, you know? So you have to do something here. And it is, you're right. It's the masterclass of self-improvement. It's putting yourself in position of something that is difficult, something that's outside of your normal nature. This is why I've said before, I've commented on the past. You know how you hear people who tell you, you know, just be yourself. Just be yourself. Yeah. Just don't worry about it. Just be yourself. Well, again, you know, if I was myself, I wouldn't be doing any of this. I wouldn't be talking to you right now if that was myself, right? Because that's just like, you know, I'm sitting here talking to a perfect stranger. I don't really know this person. I don't know what kind of personality they have. I don't know what they're going to throw at me. There's no pre-questions ever that have been sent to me or anything like that. I know in general what we're going to talk about, but, you know, who knows what's going to be coming at me. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. But if I was just myself, I wouldn't be doing really a lot of things I would be doing. I wouldn't be leading fitness classes. I wouldn't be podcasting. I wouldn't be starting a publishing company. I wouldn't be in the digital media space. So I've said before that this idea of just being yourself sounds like great advice, but it's really not great advice. You know,
you might stay in a loop. I mean, if you're yourself, you might stay in a loop and just stay on the couch or, you know, stay in the zone that you're most comfortable and never challenge yourself. I always bring up this comment to musicians, but David Bowie brought up this thing, right? And they asked him, how come you're always like shape-shifting? How come you're always changing your genres? And he said, I don't feel comfortable as an artist unless I'm treading water. That he would go, like, if you think about it, like, he's Ziggy Stardust, he's a rock and roll, right? Then the next day he's working with Luther Vandross.
Right.
And Luther Vandross can sing better than he can. Instead of being intimidated, he took it as a learning experience. And he played with Stevie Ray Vaughan, who plays better guitar than he can.
Right?
So he would go and put himself in situations where he wasn't the best.
Right.
To push himself into genres that he wasn't really great at.
Right. Exactly. But
then he became this kind of enigma that he could cross through things because he was willing to maybe fail, maybe not do as well, maybe lose some of his audience because he didn't stay Ziggy, didn't stay Thin White Duke, he didn't stay in the characters. He would, yeah, I did that. I could stay there, but that's boring to stay there. So you would shapeshift and change. And when you're willing to push the envelope and willing to, you know, take the hit that you don't really know what you're doing, but you're going to try it and see what happens.
Right. And, you know, it's so easy to fall into mediocrity because it asks nothing of you. It requires nothing of you. And that's, I think that's a loop that a lot of people do get caught up into. And just the line that you should just be yourself just sort of reinforces it. I don't think it's malicious advice. I don't think it's given to anybody as something that's supposed to sabotage them. I think it's given with all the best intentions in the world. But I think if you really want something more for yourself, then you have to accept that maybe who you are in your entirety it's just not enough. And you got to kind of build, not change who you are necessarily, but build upon who you are. Take what you are as the foundations and then build up from there. That's all I come back with. I mean, I don't know where you stand on that.
I think a lot of times that we have this inner child that's kind of pushed down. Mm-hmm. So when we're a kid, we immediately jump into things. You jump on that bike and you keep on falling down. You keep on doing it. You don't get, if I know adults, it's like, I can't ride a bike and they won't even try. I can't roller skate. They won't even try. Right. They can't swim. I won't even try. But the kid, they'll go jump in the lake. They'll go do it. Right. When you have that inner child kind of thing, like, I don't know what I can't do and I'm going to try it. I think we've kind of teach ourselves out of that. It was like, you got to grow up. But what I found with a lot of creative people, they still have that kind of childlike curiosity. And they don't listen to the haters and say, well, you shouldn't do that. You can't do that. You could never imagine doing it. That they said, well, why not? Why can't I do that? And so it's still whatever their dream is, they don't think it's impossible. They think it's possible to actually evolve and to have like a growth mindset where, I'm going to go and try to expand rather than to contract and stay in a narrow lane, you know? That's
exactly right. And if you do ask them, why can't I do that? Why shouldn't I do that? Why is that so impossible? The answers you get back are usually not very good or not very convincing, or, you know, they just kind of struggle to give you an answer at all. And they just kind of hope that they can just that line that, well, you can't do that. That's not for you. It'll just hang there because most people won't challenge it. They'll just kind of, because I don't know, a lot of people have it kind of built into them or beaten into them that, you're right. Maybe it is too good for me. And so
I mean, there's a lot of that imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, you were told as a kid, you're never going to amount to nothing. You're ugly. You're this. And that. So those child things, the things that happen in childhood, they stick with you. I've talked to tons of people, therapists over time, that people are stuck in these glass ceilings or boxes that were created in their childhood or created in their youth. And they don't, what happened? We lost you. Well, we were having a good conversation and it just dropped out. So hopefully it'll jump back in. Maybe just had an internet outage that we kind of worry about, but something happened. So we're just waiting for him to come back. Sean Colton, we were just talking to him. We just had like a technical difficulty. Hopefully he can get back on. So we were having a good conversation with Sean Colton, creator of two podcasts and CEO of Dark Age Media. I don't know if they had some kind of power outage where he is. We were having a great conversation with him. Another couple of, here he goes.
Sorry.
So I was explaining we just had a technical difficulty, but we're back.
Yeah, we're back. Sorry about that.
That's all right. But we were just talking, I think, just about limiting beliefs and, you know, people self-sabotage, that kind of thing. We can, you know, go from there.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is too, is like, most people, you know, they get told things that about themselves that aren't necessarily true. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of them do get it from the people who are closest to them, like their friends or their friends and family or their siblings and stuff like that. But a lot of times it's coming from people who, you know, whose opinion you really shouldn't put you shouldn't value very much anyway, because they're strangers. They're nothing to you. They're not friends. Yeah. They're not family. They're just people. Especially now, this is all the more worse now these days in social media.
All the haters. You put your post out and then somebody goes like, I hated it. So they take the time to tell you they hated it. Well, you know, you could have just
passed it by.
But you find it important to let people know how much you hate things. Right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's very bad. Being a creative person, that's fine. Like, if you don't dig the vibe that we're giving off as artists, fine, move to the next artist. But this constantly, you know, we get some people who will just continuously say, but you hate it. Why are you always here? Why are you always here if you hate it?
Right. Right. And yeah, no good answers to questions like that, for sure.
Yeah, like that. So that's why you have to like not let that hurt you. Because I know there are some artists that they're so people pleasing that if they get the bad reviews, they get, you know, they get the Billboard bad review, they get the Pitchfork bad review, and then it kills them. Because they take the thing about being an artist, your vulnerability, if you're tapping into it, it's you. So that piece of work is a lot of you.
Yeah.
So sometimes artists will take it very personal if they get like hit with a bad result. But a lot of times, to me, it's a learning experience, because when you put something out there, it's like the law of attraction. Some people are going to get it. Some people don't get it. A lot of great artists, the first time they put something out, like a Hendrix, his recording engineers thought the feedback was terrible. They tried to edit it out. They said, what are you doing? You're too loud. You do this, you do that. So he kept on pushing and said, this is what I hear in my head, and this is what's going to be there. And so sometimes your immediate reaction from people around you, you have to kind of, if you believe in what you're doing, then you go with what you feel is what you're trying to express.
Exactly. And there's very few rules to really anything in life, especially when it comes to arts and creativity. You know, there's certain rules you should follow in life, for sure. But when it comes to expression, I think you are and should be bound by absolutely nothing. So if you put something out there, and the other part of it too is that a lot of this has to do with looking for outside validation. And if you are someone who is constantly searching for that outside validation, and if you don't get it, then it's going to affect you a lot. So if you're going to do something, you have to do something for your own reasons too. It's wonderful when people are really receptive to the things you do. You know, if I, you know, have a podcast, I think it's a boomer of a podcast. I put it out there and it gets a lot of heavy traffic. A lot of people respond to it. I get a lot of good responses to it. That's great. It's an intoxicating feeling. You know, but I know that's not going to be every podcast I make. And I'm quite sure that, you know, I think just about everyone I've talked to, you know, with the exception of one person in particular, has been absolutely great. But I'm pretty sure that there's been a few out there who probably walked away from that interview with me and said, man, this guy sucks. You know, well, you know, I did what I could do. Right. You know, and I'm sorry that you didn't think it was very good. But I did what I could do. I put it out there and it is what it is. Like you told me before we started recording here, you don't do any edits. I do very little editing other than just kind of like, you know, intro videos and, you know, conclusion videos, exit videos, that kind of stuff. But I don't really mess with anything anybody said, or any kind of pauses or anything, stuff like that. I kind of just let it be for the most part, unless there's like a glaring problem. I mean, you really have to resign yourself to the fact that if you're going to do something, do it one to the best of your capabilities and do it for your own reasons. And once it's out there, it's open for interpretation. People can take it or leave it, and people hate on it. Well, then they hate on it. That's all. There's nothing you can do about that.
Well, I think sometimes it's like you think about, you know, being like in the flow state or in the, you know, being in the present and, you know, being present rather than there's a lot of, you know, in our industry, like in music, there's this whole thing about the perfection trap, like because of digital controls, I can go in and I can make everything perfect. But I'm a big fan of old music. So if I go back to stuff from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s before all the tech, the heavy tech we have today, there's a lot of mistakes on vinyl. There's a lot of mistakes on the tapes, on stuff even from the 80s. The stuff that's actually imperfections are what we call happy accidents, are part of the nature of art. But when you get to this point where you want everything to be perfect pitch, no timing errors, well, in music, the timing differences are kind of part of the flow.
Yeah.
Right. Part, you know, even the pitch differences are sometimes very authentic or vulnerabilities. Like you think about a guy like Neil Young, his pitch sometimes can be very vulnerable to the point where it's like cracking or not totally perfect. Like he can actually do a perfect performance when he sings with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He does. But sometimes he chose to be more kind of punk or less tied down, less like trying to be a perfect performance. And it was kind of like the birth of punk music. A lot of people go back and look at early Neil Young and say he was willing to put on record stuff that some people said, well, that's not actually presentable. And he's like, well, this is what I feel. This is what I think the song, this moment is what captures what I think the song is. So I'm not going to change it. I'm just going to let it be what it is.
Exactly. You know, and people are the same way about like movies too. Like some people won't watch old movies because the production value isn't quite as good as what we have available in terms of like, especially if like we're talking about special effects.
Old special effects.
Yeah, old special effects, you know, but it has its own charm here too. And you can have you can have an appreciation for, no, it doesn't look as good as the stuff that comes out now that's all computer digitally created effects. But it has, for its time, you can appreciate the fact that for its time, it was state of the art stuff and it was, and it was considered
state of the art. It was like the best. That's Star Wars. I mean, the first Star Wars compared to like what we had seen before was Star Trek 2001, Space 1999. Then we see Star Wars and it was like a leap forward. And it's like compared to the CGI and all the stuff you can do now. They even went back and re-edited. But I grew up watching that movie when it came out as a kid. You know, I'm a child of the 70s. I'm 56 years old. And I was so, I saw that movie like five times because I had never seen anything like that. You know, I saw 2001, but then to me, and I still capture that moment of how it was. And I actually like to watch the unaltered version because it's a kind of, it's a moment I saw in the theater as a kid. And I think it's perfect the way it was, you know?
And that, and by that same token, you know, sometimes the things can look so good and so perfect. If we're talking again about movie effects, things can look so good and so perfect that it actually backfires because, because it's so advanced that, you know, it's realistic, but it's also, it comes across as just not being realistic, you know? And I'll give you an example in my own case. Like I'm a child of the 90s. All right. I'm 41 years old. the movie that got me into movies in terms of like big budget productions was Jurassic Park. All right. So now that movie, I loved it. It was to me what Star Wars was to you. I saw it 5-6 times in the theater. It blew my mind. It was absolutely captivating to me as a 10-year-old kid seeing this stuff, these lifelike dinosaurs. I'd never seen anything like that. No one's seen anything like that. That was the, you know, cream of the crop. That was the cream of the crop of movie special effects when it came out. They've made, now we all know they've made so many sequels to Jurassic Park. Now, you know, the sequels are still coming out too. Now, everything is absolutely CGI, the dinosaurs, you know, they're slick looking, but they're not scary looking, you know, and the thing about Jurassic Park, the original one, is like, yeah, you had the computer generated images in there, too, but you also had robotics, puppetry, that like kind of stuff. Right.
Puppet type puppetry.
Exactly. So you had these creatures there that look like flesh and blood three-dimensional creatures, because not everything was done through computers. The models had to be built. Robots had to be engineered. You know, you had to get teams of people here to run these things, to make them move. You know, they had to interact with human actors and stuff like that. It was a long, long process to get this stuff going. They had the CGI, but they used it to fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the robotics and the animatronic puppetry couldn't quite get. So they used it as a supplement, but now it's the whole thing.
Yeah, and there's a problem. Like I totally agree, because it goes to this thing about being too perfect. And there's something about the artistry, and in music, we run into the same thing. I can sample and I can use AI and I can loop and I can do all this stuff and not really even know how to play a guitar or a piano. Mm-hmm. Just know how to be a producer. Right. That's not a bad skill set. Producers know grooves. They know what works together. But there's a difference from being a producer and actually being a musician. They can play the bass guitar through the whole 5 minutes of the song.
Right.
And something about actually really playing that bass for real, rather than looping it and sampling it and having maybe micro timing errors or what you say are errors, but they're really the feel. Mm-hmm. So if you have a player that plays the length of the song rather than somebody just grabbing bits and throwing them on a board, that's real playing. That's using an analog instrument, not a sampled instrument, not a, you know, like some kind of like digital recreation. It's a real analog instrument, like playing real drums versus a drum machine. A drummer that plays original beats that they constructed versus the drum machine, you'll always hear certain differences that the machine can never do. There's certain things about human drumming that a machine will never replicate. And if when you just think the machine can just replace the human, and in the tech, we can replace the artistry of the puppetry. You know, this is where people start to make the mistakes. It's like, there's something about things that are imperfect that are beautiful.
Right. Exactly.
And maybe they're missing the point.
Right. I'm not dogging on electronic music. I like a lot of electronic music. I like the fact what a lot of these people can do with their stuff, to how they layer things, how they actually engineer and tweak things, and they create this wall of sound that is, you know, oftentimes very interesting to me. But you're right. I can definitely tell the difference between something that has been manufactured versus something that has been actually a product of, you know, human ingenuity, you know, an actual person who is playing a guitar or playing a bass or playing whatever, and maybe doesn't hit every single note just perfectly. You know, it's funny because I was actually at a band with a friend of mine several weeks ago, and they're a live band, and their bass player, at some point, something happened to his bass. It gave off some weird noise. it gave off some weird noise while he was playing, and it was an accident. Like, it wasn't meant to happen. And everyone was kind of going frantic, because like, where's that coming from? Why is that happening? What's going on here? La, la, la. And I thought it was part of the show. I thought he had meant to do that. I thought it was just an effect he was doing with his bass. And I liked it.
You liked it, yeah.
Yeah, it gave off a weird sound. Yeah. It gave off
a happy accident. That's a happy accident.
Right, exactly. It gave off a weird sound that maybe was a little bit anachronistic to everything else that was going on, what everyone else was playing in the band. But I liked it. I thought it was cool. I thought he actually meant to do that. But everyone else was looking at him like, what's going on over there? What's happening? You know?
That's interesting, because there's a couple famous things, like the Kinks, like You Really Got Me, that song. The amp was broken and the engineers wanted to fix it, but then Ray Davies said no, and his brother, Dave Davies, said, no, there's something about that, the fact that amp is broken, that makes this song sound so different that we're going to put it out with the broken amp sound. And the engineers and the producers are like, no, that's terrible. It's terrible. But it actually became an iconic type of sound. And then other people wanted to replicate it, and they had to actually create equipment to replicate it. Yeah, because it was an accident. The amp was broken.
So that kind of nasient, that's a broken amp.
Yeah, the amp was broken.
Oh, very cool. I did not know that. See,
there's a lot of stories like that in music where stuff was like, you know, it wasn't, the mic wasn't right. The actual board was a little off. The timing's off. The pitch is off, and it actually makes the song.
Yeah.
And then today, what people are losing is some of that kind of like, you know, happy accident or be living in a moment or accepting what you actually hear and trusting it.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are like, oh, no, I've got to go on the oscilloscope and make it perfect. It's like, what did you hear? Did you hear something that was interesting, or do you just go with the really abstract or just technical? I got to get it to match on the oscilloscope what I think it should be. Versus actually listening to what you actually did. And this is with people too. Like, did you actually listen to are you actually reading the room? Like, if you go to give a speech and you're like somebody who goes and gives speeches and you have a set written speech on your teleprompter, but you're reading a room and nobody's really getting it. So then you need to kind of address like moment in time, like what you're saying is not carrying over. You need to adjust. And if you just think you're going to stay on your script, well, you're probably going to bomb then. It's like if you're willing to adjust to the moment.
Yeah, that's something else. Like fitness training has taught me to improvise when I need to as well. Because when I was leading these classes, you know, I would come up with all these elaborate things that people would do. I try to make it as fun as possible. Like try to make, you know, all these really coach these people into doing these really cool maneuvers and things like that and kind of get them into this headspace. Like maybe like they're actually in a kickboxing fight here. Like this bag is an opponent. Keep moving, keep doing this, you know, so it becomes more lifelike. But there were times when what I was trying to communicate just was not going over very well. People weren't getting it. They were messing up. They were giving me these confused looks. And so I had to pivot and say, instead of going through all these elaborate, you know, maneuvers, let's just go back to something basic just to keep people in this flow. So keep things going, you know? And so, people get their workout in, they're not getting pissed off at me because I'm confusing them, and they can walk away saying, oh, that was good. No, it wasn't everything that I had planned, but you know, you make a plan and then you keep the options open.
And yeah, it's not that you don't plan, but you're willing to deviate from your plan if the moment necessitates that you can.
Right, exactly. And it's the same thing with podcasting. I can't tell you how many times I've hosted somebody, and you know, I've had to read the guest that I'm talking to. Like, and some people, a lot of people, they ease up a little bit. A lot of people go into it like they're kind of cagey. They're kind of very, very probably nervous. They don't podcast very much. They're new to it. And so it takes them a little bit to kind of warm up to it. And once the ball gets rolling, then things really get rolling. But sometimes, you know, I generally talk for about 45 minutes to an hour, but sometimes though, there's just not really enough there. You know,
if you feel it not kicking, like you can feel that you get these silences.
Right.
Like, typically when I get people, I try to get them, you know, listening skills is like, I listen to what they're saying and I let them make their point. Mm-hmm. And if they have all these questions they like to be asked, but if I dive into something and it deviates from all those things, then I let it go that way. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of treat it like a fusion jazz session.
Right.
Like if the bass player deviates from the main composition, it's not that we don't know it, but we're going to deal with the fact that he decided to take it somewhere else.
Right.
And if you can trust that, It like if you can live like jazz, then things will go a lot easier than if you get flustered because it's not going. What I've run into is some people want to go on a script, and I'm very jazz-like. Yeah. And then I realize that they want it, then I have to shift my jazz strategy to, oh, they want me to go question by question that they had prepared.
Yeah.
And
that's
what they want. So I said, okay, I'll give them what they want. because I can see they're getting frustrated. So, okay, I'll go give them what they want. They don't want to do free flow.
Right. Yeah, exactly too. And that's why, like, I don't put any restrictions or any kind of expectations on people when they talk to me. If you look at my profile, it's very sparse. I don't throw any questions out. Like, it's your show. You ask me what you want to ask me. And I kind of do the same thing with my own programs here. It's like, it's just like I have a set list of questions I ask just so I can have something to reflect back onto as we're going along here. If, you know, things aren't really kicking along here, we're not necessarily on code just yet. And so things are kind of dry. Now I have something I can just kind of keep things going. But if I have about maybe 10 questions, I'll maybe ask 3-4, maybe half of them.
And that's,
A good thing, right. And the rest are like follow-up questions to things that they've said. And that's how I like to go. I like to kind of keep it like improvisational jazz, where it's just like, let's start out with something here and see where it takes us. And, you know, it might work out great, might not. Again, that's the adventure of creativity.
But the weird thing is, like, what I find is that improvisational jazz thing, it works like 90% of the time for me. Mm-hmm. Most of the people, if they were nervous, they start to be less nervous because they were trying to stay on script, and that was causing them to get anxious. Mm-hmm. But if they feel like I'm actually talking to you, like I'm your friend, and right. we're just having a conversation like there's nobody else in the room,
right?
And I'm actually listening to what you say, mm-hmm. and diving into some points and not just going off of like a script. And right. so when people realize like, oh, he's actually listening to me, he's yeah. actually getting what I'm saying, right? And mm-hmm. then we can actually have like a conversation that goes back and forth.
Right. Exactly. And if you just go by a script, I feel like you're really kind of missing out on the magic of what you could be, a conversation you could be having with this person. I interviewed a woman several weeks ago. She was an immigrant. She lives in Dallas. She was an immigrant from, I want to say Estonia. I'm forgetting if she said Estonia or Latvia. I feel like Latvia, actually. Latvia. She lives in Houston, Texas right now, but she was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And, you know, I asked her, well, what made you want to move at a young age from everything you knew back in your home country to now living in Houston, Texas for the last 25 years? And at the end of our interview, she told me, like, you know, I've done like 50 something interviews. No one has ever asked me why I left Latvia.
Yeah, because they go by the script.
Right. Like everyone, yeah. And some people, you know, some of these guys, they pump out like several dozen interviews in a day. I don't do that. And so they got it down to a science. But yeah, I found that just incredible. Like someone who is a young person decides they're going to leave Eastern Europe and move to the United States and build a business and build a life there, pretty much from scratch. And not one person asks you, so why'd you do something like that? Why don't you just stay back at home where things are comfortable, where things are where you knew, where your family is and all that stuff? I just found it's mystifying to me that no one would ever think to ask her that.
Yeah, because I think some people, they don't actually, you know, think of it in this, like, I don't know, they get into a formula. Like, mm-hmm. we're so into algorithms today. It's like, oh, the top 10 processes, and you need to do these steps. And everybody wants these magic bullet steps.
Right.
So they think that if I get this formula and I get this algorithm, I get this way to do it, then that's the only way to do it. Where I'm kind of, if I'm coming from an improvisational kind of experimental music mindset, my idea is I like to kind of challenge things and do it and rip it up and invert it and
right. Go
whatever way I feel like. And so that doesn't necessitate the typical in the box thinking.
No, that's chaos for a lot of people.
Yeah, they can't stand it. They can't deal with it. And one of the things I start to ask people is like, what are three things about yourself that people wouldn't expect? Right. And I'll do it kind of near the end of the show, and we're kind of near the end of this show, but mm-hmm. if, like, there are three things about your life that you don't think people would immediately find apparent, what would those be?
Three things about my life that people don't find apparent. Well, I'm very shy. I don't like going out and meeting people. Kind of like, I think I alluded to this earlier. I'm a very introverted person. I'm an only child. So I grew up just with things just being me and me and my mom mostly. And so I got used to being inside my own head. And, you know, that's a good thing because you're comfortable in your own company. It's a bad thing because it does kind of stunt you socially. You know, it's, you know, it's both an advantage and a handicap. So that's something that probably most people, well, I mean, some people might kind of get that from me if you met me in real person, but online, just given what I do, you may not suspect that, that is definitely me.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of times, you know, stage personas, I run into a lot. Like when I produce with like work with a musician, and they can present this like a hyperbolic kind of like way over the top. Mm. But when you deal with them, they're like super nervous, have tons of anxiety, not self-confident. But they get on stage, they're like Mick Jagger. Prince. Prince was famous for that. Like, be on stage when you try to talk to him, he's like painfully shy, painfully awkward, not as smooth as he appears. And even actors can be get into that zone. It's like they could do this amazing performance. You try to talk to him, and you can like, oh, I can't even get anything out of him. He's like very difficult. He can't. But on stage, he looks like he's like he can be anybody. He can do everything. He's like, is this people have these different like masks that they put on. And it's not always what it appears to be.
Absolutely not.
And then I guess if your audience, you talk about your company, we didn't really go into it like dark media. How did you decide to have that, create that company? What was the reason behind it?
The podcasting started out with Fitness Reborn with Sean, which was really, I kind of intended that podcast to be like an adjunct to my fitness business. So I was a fitness trainer, and so I have this podcast. And the idea was that I could use this as a platform, maybe for my own clientele, but also for myself and whoever else wants to listen to it, that, you know, there's so much information, so much knowledge out there, so many different people from different points of view, different thoughts. And, you know, there's so much out there. And I guess, you know, I started this during COVID, and, you know, me and just about any other person that had a microphone and a laptop and internet access, hey, I can do a podcast, you know, that's the thing to do. And so I did it. And really, so from there, I decided I was going to focus less on the fitness business and more on the fitness podcast. Eventually, because I saw this just kind of continuing to grow, and it's still growing. And in my infinite wisdom as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, I figured, well, you know, maybe I should put this under a heading of some type. So I chose Dark Age Media. I'm not entirely clear on where that came from. I think it was kind of like, I think it was inspired by my fitness company, because my fitness company was called Renaissance Fitness. And Renaissance, my emblem, my insignia was Da Vinci's Universal Man, Universal Man, Da Vinci, that kind of stuff. And it was just kind of like an offshoot of that, because Leonardo da Vinci is like the very antithesis of everything having to do with the Dark Ages, right? You know, he's a Renaissance man. He stands for scientific, artistic, enlightenment, and, you know, like the very pinnacle of everything that we associate with the Italian Renaissance is Leonardo da Vinci. And so Dark
very
Age.
Expansive dark, person. Yeah, it's very like, don't have a lot of boundaries, can mix the arts with science.
Right,
with
exactly.
Art. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, that's. Yeah, right. Different type of, you know, Renaissance people are thought of as like, wow, they're multitaskers.
Right. Right. And so Dark Age was kind of like, I guess, the opposite, almost like a regression from that, I guess, in some ways. That's kind of a negative spin, but I guess it is that. So we had the Renaissance, and now we're in Dark Age. And I don't know, it just sounded cool. Dark Age Media. Yeah. And then I got this cool text, this cool font. And, you know, I was playing it around with on my Canva account. I was just kind of mixing. That's the other thing too, is like the graphic design of all this stuff here. That really just, I love it. I love it. All this editing stuff that you can work with. I just love it. And I was just tooling around with it more and more and more. And it started to come together. And I was just like, you know, I'm not sure this makes a whole lot of sense, but I'm
it makes totally sense. You know, a lot of times people come at things like, you know, the punk aesthetic, mm-hmm. the idea, like Ice Boot, you had all these progressive bands like Yes and Genesis, Led Zeppelin, and all that. And then people say you come to Clash and the Sex Pistols and the Ramones come along. And suddenly you don't have to have the best voice. You don't have to be a Roger Plant. You don't have to be like, you know, all these great, perfect pitch singers and perfect players, that you can have passion. Right. So the idea is that you can kind of regress a little bit and say, I don't have to be a virtuoso.
Right.
I can have heart. I can be. And then you get bands like the Talking Heads. Like, well, these guys are kind of weird. What's that? Because you're willing to entertain that I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not, you know, like the perfect pitch. I'm not Marvin Gaye. Like, I'm not going to have that level of voice, but I'm going to do something like David Byrne. He's like, I'm going to come out there and just be this strange cat and try things. And like, wow, I can connect. Right. So this punk aesthetic in music is like, even if you're not, like, you can find a punk aesthetic in multiple forms. Like, fact that you're willing to kind of challenge and be kind of go against the grain a little bit, be a little, you know.
I guess I kind of thought, like, because, you know, eventually a couple months ago, I started my second podcast, Dear DSM, which is all about the city and culture and people of Des Moines, Iowa. And I live in Iowa, for those of you who don't know. And Des Moines is the capital city. Mm-hmm. And Des Moines is such a neat place. It really is. It doesn't get hardly any fanfare in terms of its cultural output and its potential, like, nothing compared to what like Kansas City or Chicago or all these other cities in the Midwest. But Des Moines has so much talent. It's just crazy. And the more I dig into it, the more I'm finding, like, we have a,
you're underserved.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's underserved. And you know, I'm finding out more and more that, you know, we've got a large rap industry, or a burgeoning rap industry in Des Moines. You know, we've got,
that's what we need. We need a new scene, because sometimes the old scenes are too much.
Right.
We need new scenes, like get people to check it out.
Right. You know, and as I speak to more and more people, it's like, it's just all these different artists are coming out. You know, a lot of them, like I said, are part of the rap scene, but there's a lot of like jazz fusion, rock and roll, punk groups there too. And you know, we all have kind of like a mutual interest where they want the exposure, I want the exposure, so we're kind of serving we're kind of serving each other's needs. Going back to what you said earlier, is like, we're swimming in the same water here, you know we both want the exposure. I want the exposure for my podcast, you want the exposure for your songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's just kind of like help each other out here, and let's just make this happen here. And, you know,
if you create a collective scene, like, you know, if you, like, part of what I was originally doing with my podcast is creating like an emerging independent artist.
Yeah.
Space. We even did like festivals where we did 3-day festivals of all the bands we interviewed. Went and played 3-day festivals for 2 years. We did these PEG bedroom producer festivals where we had the bands come on and do live sets from like their bedroom or their basement or wherever they were. We had an Australian band do it from a soundstage. Nice. We had other bands do it from their bedroom. We had other people do like music videos and present them, and they had a half hour to present their material. Rather than do an interview, we had already done the interview, let them do a little mini concert on a festival. Mm-hmm. And so like, when you start to create your own stage, then you can bring people onto those stages, you know, and then give them, you know, a chance to be heard and seen, which I think that's what we're trying to do as podcasters, I believe.
Right. And I think, you know, honestly, that's the way it's always kind of worked. Like, you know, back in the olden days when artists and radio DJs were working in tandem with each other, you know, a lot of a lot of bands and a lot of artists got recognition because somebody who had a radio station and a pretty sizable audience and maybe had an ear for something that was new and could appreciate it said, hey, I like this. How about we get you on the show? How about we play a song or two? If you've got something, you got a tape for me or something like that, you know, I think you've got real potential here. I think that my listeners would appreciate this, or if they don't really, they've never heard anything like this, but I think I like it and they listen to me. So I assume that they listen to the things that I say. And so if I put my muscle behind you, who knows, you might actually just take off here. So,
well, I think it's the hope for music, because we have so many like corporate structures trying to kind of dumb down the variety of music.
All right.
And what I always liked is the local DJ scenes, where, you know, in the old radio world, is you have a Detroit scene, a Boston scene, New York scene, Los Angeles scene, you know, all these scenes, and different DJs would push those bands from those scenes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And then people would get to hear the Chicago sound or the Mississippi Delta sound or the, you know, the New York sound. And you would get to be able to get it. It wouldn't just be like, oh, there's the national decided sound from the record label.
Right. Like,
you would get these people coming up from the basement, from the underground.
Right.
And so I've always been a big purveyor of like the college radio, indie radio, you know, mixtape type audience, underground, bootlegger kind of idea. It's like get those people to as many ears as possible.
Right. And it only takes, you know, it only takes one artist or one group to really put a city on a map, you know, because who even care about Liverpool before the Beatles?
Yeah, they did. Nobody cared.
who gave a damn about Liverpool before the Beatles? Who cared about Seattle before Nirvana? Yep. You know, it's just like, you know, all these little, you know, kind of backwater, well, not really backwater, but just kind of like non-entity cities and communities that no one really thinks about. But then someone comes onto the scene that attracts enough attention, and it's like, wow. And now we have things called the Seattle sound or the Chicago sound, like, or the Minneapolis sound, that kind of stuff.
Minneapolis sound for Prince.
Prince, right? Who comes, like, again, like Minneapolis, who thinks of Minneapolis? Who would think of Minneapolis without
Minneapolis has a sound. Prince, but Prince, you had Paul Westerberg, you had Huska Du, you actually had a Minneapolis scene that was kind of varied. It had punk bands and it had funk bands, like the time of Prince, you know, and then you have guys like, you know, the Replacements, you know, Huska Du coming out of that city. It's like, wow, that's actually a scene I really got into. Being in the 80s, I was into punk along with funk and jazz, but it just, like, I think just allowing people to be very expansive and you just like, okay, you know, maybe you don't dig who I'm talking to today, but maybe you'll dig who I talk to tomorrow. And so just tune in, because it's going to be different all the time, and maybe you like that. And so try that and see if people dig the variety. You know, I think that's the best we can do for our audience, is like, if we're entertained, then maybe you ought to check it out, because there's a reason why we think this is cool. So check us out.
Right. And going back to what you said about how corporate companies kind of like engineer a lot of the stuff that people listen to, or, you know, I think that's kind of a growing problem too, because we have, and this is kind of goes to the whole importance of independent media and independent outlets, to where they can find these things and they don't have to go through all types of checks and balances and executives and
gates, the gate
all these gatekeepers who are just looking for, okay, like, is this actually going to chart? You know, is this going to be a worthwhile return on investment, that sort of thing here? And it's something I think it's not a 21st century thing by any means. It's always kind of been that way. But ever since the American Idol thing took off 20 years ago, it is really just kind of it's exploded in terms of just how pervasive it is, that, you know, every person, everything has to have some sort of commercial, wide commercial formula, wide commercial appeal for them to get any appreciation from any sort of major label here. And, and because, and that not only applies to music, it applies to information, it applies to news, everything. And so, you know, you have the same, maybe four or five companies controlling everything. And so the importance of independent media now, I think is more important than ever has been. Like, the digital landscape that we live in, you know, it's really weird, because again, with social media, because you can get all kinds of information at any point in the day. Most of it's useless. Most of it is just like, you know, clickbait, filler information. But, you know, we're living in a time when you can learn, you can know everything at the same time, know nothing.
Yeah, because so much useless information.
Right. Absolutely useless information, and whatever potentially good information or worthwhile information you are getting has been put through so many filters that you don't even know, like,
what the real deal is.
Right, yeah. And you don't even know what you're hearing now or what you're reading now is actually true, because you don't know how many different levels it went through. It filtered
it
down.
Edited to just be titillating or give you a piece of the real truth, piece of the truth. And so if you only get a piece of something, it's like a lot of times the clickbait, it will usually be diametrically opposed to like what it actually says.
Right.
You actually read it and it's this headline that doesn't match the topic.
Right.
It was just designed to get you to jump into it. And it's like, well, that's not even what they said it was.
So if you heard like some sort of soundbite, or you read an article, and maybe if you backtracked it a couple different steps from the origin of the actual bit of information, then you might find out it's completely different than what you were fed.
And it's out of context.
And just this maybe 5 second or maybe 30 second long blurb that you just listened to. And so, you know, if you want to call that a dark age, there you go, because everything is just kind of regressing.
Yeah, there's a regression. I remember Frank Zappa, I'm a big fan of Frank Zappa. Oh, yeah. He used to say, you know, back in the day, we didn't like our kind of cigar smoking executives in the music industry, but like, I wish we had them now, because he said the guys today, they, you know, the old guys would say, well, I don't really understand this music, but maybe somebody will like it, so I'll put it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where Zappa says to now, you got guys who say, well, I do understand it, and I want to just take like an algorithm and repeat it and only repeat this. And I'm going to limit. So they're funneling what they think is, they think they have too much expertise. And like Frank said, these guys are kind of dangerous to the arts because they think they know more than they do, where they have a very discerning taste that is super limiting. Mm-hmm. And he said some of the most experimental bands that ever were allowed to happen in the 60s to like the 80s. And then the big companies took over and said, oh, no, we know better. And then you don't get that. You don't get the Lou Reed, Velvet Undergrounds. You don't get like the Talking Heads. Like, would you get a band like the Talking Heads today to come out? Probably not. You wouldn't get like a Lou Reed, Velvet Underground. You wouldn't get Funkadelic probably couldn't even get out the door. Like there's so many gates like are actually stopping really good music, because it's like, oh, let's get another clone of Taylor Swift or Beyonce or whoever the top 10 rapper is, and not actually looking at the fact is music. Hendrix was somebody that you never heard before, you know. The Beatles, the way they did stuff, is like that was not really being done that way. But now you don't even let innovation come through.
No,
you just want to repeat whatever worked.
Right. It's a very much closed environment. Entertainment, media, information. It's really sad. And so my hope is with my company, especially with my publication, Same O Lives, by bringing people in that I think have something substantive that they can offer the world. And it doesn't have to be anything necessarily that is close to what I do, but somebody that has things that they can contribute that, you know, together we can kind of grow with this publication and we can get your voices out there. Cause there's a lot of talented people out there who don't get the spotlight, who don't get a lot of fanfare, who have to deal with the gatekeepers, whoever they might be. And I think this is just the brilliance of everything that we are doing here in these mediums, because there's a lot of restrictions on speech. Otherwise, there's a lot of people being canceled, for ridiculous reasons here, because it's just enough people said, I don't like what he said. Well, then I'll quote you, George Carlin, just turn it off then.
Turn it off. Yeah, that's what I always said. If you don't like the music, turn it off. Don't try to ban the Beatles.
Right.
Hey, you know, exactly. They tried to ban the Beatles because they didn't like what John Lennon said. Mm-hmm. If you don't like it, don't listen to it. Don't burn it and ban it. But that's, you know, the mindset. But we have gone over, but we were having such a good time. I didn't want to cut it down. Again, Sam O Lives, Substack.com is fully clickable. If people click there, tell people what they find there.
Well, what they find is mostly, this is where I upload all my podcasts. So this is the uploading platform for my podcast. So you'll find my podcast, Dear DSM and Fitness Reborn with Sean. I'm also working with a woman right now. I'm just helping her start her own podcast. She's in the health and wellness and fitness space, same as me. I'm working on getting her podcast up and running. She hasn't actually interviewed anybody, but we're working on that. I've got a section designated for her, so when she gets podcasts going, that'll be uploaded. You'll find articles by another contributor who I just kind of took on, a woman I interviewed not that long ago, actually. And you'll find some blogs from me too. And the blogs are varied. You know, you should go in there and check it out. I got a blog on John Coltrane, actually.
Oh, cool. I'm into that.
you should go check it out here. It's not about John Coltrane himself. It's about a particular work that he did. A lot of it, again, a lot of it is like a playground for me. It's like, oh, I got a moment of inspiration. I'm going to write about something that I think is really cool. And so you can kind of go through some of the blogs there and see that I got, you know, all kinds of different things going on there.
That's cool. I like being expansive. So if you're doing stuff that's cool, I'll check it out.
So I got opinion articles on a few different things in there. So it's a small publication. It's just taking off. It's only a few months old. My plan is to expand it with word of mouth and with content and with actual substance. So my goal here is to actually bring things to people that I think will help advance their life forward, and things that hopefully, or things that they maybe would not have known about otherwise. And so my whole goal here really at the end of the day is to be a facilitator. That's all I want.
I think that's what podcasters we do best is, and I thank you for being on the show, and it's great to talk to a fellow podcaster. Cause like, I do believe this forum is a really great forum for having freedom of expression and not being canceled and being able to say, you know, we're only canceled if we decide we don't want to do it.
So we're
as long as we decide we're going to do it, we're going to be here. So that's cool. So thank you again for being a guest on the Family Electric Ghost podcast. And everybody, we were just on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch, and we'll be on all the other podcast platforms where you can listen to podcasts or watch them by tomorrow. And thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you, Phantom. I appreciate it.